Hello, my name is Naseem Parvizi. Welcome to the Clinical Radiology podcast, focusing on cardiovascular imaging. We'll be speaking with Dr. Giles Roditi first, editor of this special issue, followed by several of the authors, Dr. Michelle Williams, Professor Stephen Harden, and finally, Professor Paul Finn. We hope you enjoy our podcast. Thank you. Our first speaker, Dr. Giles Roditi, would you please tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to be the editor of this special issue looking at cardiovascular imaging, please?
I'm Dr. Giles Roditi. I'm a consultant cardiovascular radiologist at Glasgow Royal Infirmary. I'm currently the president-elect of the British Society of Cardiovascular Imaging and the British Society of Cardiovascular CT, and so I'm very involved in non-invasive cardiovascular imaging in the UK. When a call went out for the special issues, I responded to the editor, Grant Baxter, and said I'd like to put an issue together focusing on cardiovascular imaging, because I believe that we're at a point where cardiovascular imaging is really coming into the mainstream of radiology, mainly through technological advancements that we've had in the last several years. Imaging in radiology has progressed at a pace with computerization, but we've always been looking for faster and faster imaging, and we're now at a point where the imaging we do is so fast that we can freeze the motion of the heart very easily or even unintentionally, something showing, you know, where we're going with cardiovascular imaging and what the exciting new areas that are opening up.
Tell us what this special issue highlights in terms of advances in cardiovascular imaging.
Cardiovascular CT is clearly a focus because CT is such a workhorse in UK radiology departments now. ECG-gated CT, where we're directly looking at the heart, is becoming routine. And because it's become routine, it's thrown up all the issues that we have in other areas in terms of quality assurance and the day-to-day management, producing good quality images and reporting the images to a high standard, which is why the BSCI, BSCCT partnered with the Royal College of Radiologists and the British Cardiovascular Society, and we brought out the guidelines on quality imaging. So Stephen Harden has done a review on that. And Ed Nicol, who's currently the president of the BSCI, BSCCT, has done an article looking at how quality is implemented in day-to-day practice, particularly as regards from radiation dose. The issue highlights where we're going in terms of myocardial evaluation with MRI, actually characterizing what's going on with the myocardium in terms of different disease patterns. And there's also focus on advances in sort of flow and motion imaging. Till now, we've been able to do with MRI, we've been able to monitor flow, but only in sort of small focused areas, and it's quite time consuming to get a general map of what's going on within an area of the body, and it can be quite time consuming to acquire the data and then analyze it. But now with four-dimensional flow imaging, I think that's going to really move forward how we deal with complex flow patterns in the future. And we also have an article from Paul Finn looking at MR contrast, particularly the use of ferrum oxetol as an intravascular contrast agent, which we can use in patients with renal impairment, for example. And he's done some very elegant work looking at four-dimensional imaging with ferrum oxetol in patients with complex congenital heart disease.
Sounds very exciting with all the advances in technology and techniques that are being developed for cardiovascular imaging. Next, we'll be hearing from Dr. Michelle Williams.
I'm a radiology trainee at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and I've been involved in cardiac imaging since 2009. My PhD was in CT myocardial perfusion imaging and computer tomography imaging of the heart, and I've just been appointed as a clinical lecturer in cardiothoracic radiology at the University of Edinburgh.
Thank you very much for agreeing to take part in our podcast. It was very interesting to read your article on CT myocardial perfusion imaging. Would you be able to give us a summary of what the key messages from your article are?
The review article was about CT myocardial perfusion imaging, and it was discussing the various techniques that are used to perform CT myocardial perfusion. This has been being done since about 2006 onwards, but it's really recently that we've developed techniques that can be used for a clinical rather than a research use. The paper discussed the techniques that you could use for CT myocardial perfusion imaging, some of the recent research, how to interpret the images, and potential for future uses of this technique. When it comes to imaging of the heart, we've got a few different methods to look at myocardial perfusion now. We've got MRI, we've got nuclear, we've got echo. And this article discusses that CT is now a potential other option for patients. And we've got two main techniques for doing CT myocardial perfusion imaging. We've got the snapshot technique that can be thought of as a sort of photograph, And then we've got the dynamic technique that can be thought of more as a cine or a video image. And both of these have advantages and disadvantages. So the article highlights some of the key considerations when it comes to performing and interpreting these images and who might benefit from having CT myocardial perfusion imaging. There's now two big randomized trials of CT perfusion imaging and a meta-analysis. So the paper discusses the results of those and also considers that maybe this could be a useful technique for patients with potentially heavy calcification, dense coronary artery stents, or who are unsuitable for other perfusion modalities.
Just a bit about the myocardial perfusion imaging. How does that differ to cardiac gated CT, as in how long does it take? What are the practical aspects of it?
So from a practical point of view, a CT coronary angiogram followed by a CT myocardial perfusion scan is practically the same as doing two CT coronary angiograms, except you give the patient some form of stress. So normally we give drugs such as adenosine or regadenoson to induce a physiological stress response. And you're looking at the difference in the contrast enhancement during stress rather than at rest, with the idea that you would be able to draw out areas of ischemia that are potentially appear during stress imaging but reversible during rest imaging. And the snapshot technique takes one or a small number of images right at the peak of myocardial enhancement or just after the peak of that curve. The dynamic technique takes multiple images during the wash-in and then wash-out of contrast. And so obviously you've got a difference in the potential radiation dose of these two techniques, with the dynamic technique having a higher radiation dose but the static technique having a lower radiation dose.
How commonplace is it for myocardial perfusion to be performed?
So myocardial perfusion around the world is the main way that we assess the heart. But in more recent years, CT coronary angiography is coming along as potentially a better and more widely usable and non-invasive method. When it comes to things like SPECT imaging, that's done at many centres. MRI imaging is done at a lot of centres, and stress echo is also done at a lot of centres. CT myocardial perfusion imaging is sort of the new kid on the block and has a potential role in some of the people who wouldn't be suitable for the other imaging modalities or as an add-on.
Great. Can you tell us what is the typical dose from a CT coronary angiogram and myocardial perfusion study, please?
So for a coronary angiogram, the British Society of Cardiovascular Imaging has done a big radiation dose audit that will be published shortly, looking at the radiation dose across the UK for CT coronary angiograms. And it does vary depending on the type of scanner you're using, depending on the patient's heart rate, depending on the patient's size, and depending on the clinical question that you're asking. We can now do CT coronary angiography at a 1 millisievert or less using the latest technologies. But for the average patient, it's probably more around about 4 or 5 millisieverts. When it comes to myocardial perfusion imaging with a static technique, you're basically doing a second scan. So the radiation dose comes up to about 5 to 6 millisieverts for a stress and rest protocol with the latest generations of technology. When it comes to a dynamic imaging, it depends on how many images you're planning to acquire during the wash-in of contrast, that being the most important part to get the most accurate information on. And you're talking somewhere between 15 and 20 millisieverts with the current protocol.
Most just standard CT scans should be able to implement the software and to be able to perform it. Is that correct? And do you think that would make change the way patients are managed in chest pain clinic?
From the point of view of CT coronary angiography, yes, any 64-slice scanner with electrocardiogram gating is capable of performing the images. From the point of view of myocardial perfusion and these advanced imaging techniques, you do need the higher end scanners, either your faster scanners or your wide detector scanners. So that will limit where patients can potentially have perfusion imaging. But there is also limitations to access to MRI and to SPECT. So obviously access to these different techniques is one of the things that we're going to have to think of. The big thing that's coming along is going to be the increased use of CT coronary angiography. And that's something that I suspect we're going to see a lot more of over the next few years. And we've got issues along the lines of where the scanners are, where the patients are, how quickly can we get access to these scans, because obviously the sooner the better. But also, we've got to think about how we're going to train people to be able to assess and interpret these scans. So from the point of view of the trainees, we've got a lot of work to do.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the articles in the issue because there's a big range of different techniques talked about from a variety of experts, and it should be a really interesting issue to read.
Next is Professor Stephen Harden.
I'm a cardiac thoracic radiologist at Southampton. I've been a consultant for just over 10 years. I do cardiac and thoracic imaging, but probably about 60% of my workload is cardiac. I've had quite an active role in the National Society, and it's recently been my privilege to be president. So I was president of BSCI, British Society of Cardiovascular Imaging, for 3 years, from 2012 to 2015. And part of this work that appeared in ClinRad recently actually was from a standards document that we wrote during my time as president.
Could you tell us a bit about the document you have written about the safe practice of CT coronary angiography, please?
So we decided that we needed to write some guidelines, agreed guidelines and standards for the performance of CT coronary angiography by departments in this country. And this partly came about because we were aware that there was a variation in practice from one centre to another across the UK, largely through anecdotal discussions at conferences and meetings. And we felt now was quite a good time to do this because of the increased interest in coronary artery CT and increased activity across the country. Is it important? Does it matter? Well, actually it does, because of two important aspects of patient safety related to the scan. The first is that, unlike many CT scans, a CT coronary angiography actually requires pre-procedural drugs. And while there are certain other forms of CT that require pre-scan drugs, what's different about CT coronary angiography is that these drugs, by definition, will alter cardiovascular hemodynamics. So clearly they need to be administered in correct form to the right patients, and one needs to be aware of contraindications. So that's the first general patient safety aspect. And the second is radiation dose. And actually, when CT coronary angiography was first developed, the radiation doses were very high. But nowadays, with modern techniques and careful attention to detail, it is possible to perform these scans for a really quite low radiation dose. And so we felt, for those two reasons, now was a good time to establish some clear guidelines such that the scans could be performed to a high quality, but with patient safety as paramount.
That's great. Thank you. How did you come to realise there was variation in practice? How did you decide on how you set the guidelines, and how do you know people are actually applying them to their practice?
So the answer to your first question is the how we found out about variations in practice, and that's largely anecdotal at conferences with obviously a group of individuals together at meetings from all over the country. Just in informal discussion, it becomes quite clear that practice varies from one centre to another, and in those two particular areas I mentioned, in terms of drugs administered, there was a significant variation. And in terms of the radiation dose delivered, there was a massive variation. And so it was for that reason that that's what really made us decide that now was a good time to do this. In terms of putting together a group, we felt it was important that this should apply to all those practitioners that were performing coronary artery CT. So to radiologists and to cardiologists, but also radiographers and physicists. So we were keen that a working party that developed these standards represented UK practice, but also from a multi-specialty point of view, that actually everyone's interests, all the various professionals involved in performing the CT scan, had representation and could make their case. In terms of the finer points of how we came up with the individual guidance, there is some evidence from published work, and where there was evidence, we used that evidence. There are other areas in which there's no formal evidence, and actually it's quite difficult to gather evidence. And so for those areas, we decided to use a combination of agreed best practice from amongst this working party of multi-professional specialists. We hope that the objective from this is partly that everyone is now aligned nationally and potentially internationally in terms of doing it in the same way, but also that we felt that quite what the future holds in terms of how we demonstrate how good our practice is difficult to know, but we felt that these guidelines were adopted and adhered to relatively rigorously, that it would be quite a good sign that units using them would be performing to a high standard. partly from the patient safety point of view, as I said, but particularly from the point of view of radiation dose. And while there's quite a lot of focus on radiation dose now, there clearly is a limit to how low you can push it. We recently ran a survey of all those interested centres across the UK. We asked them to collect prospectively all their radiation dose data for coronary artery CT for a 1 month period. And it demonstrated quite a significant variation, up to a tenfold variation radiation dose across the country. So we know that there was a difference there. It shows that the majority of centres actually use really quite a low radiation dose, but the point I wanted to make is that we can't keep, at this stage, pushing it even lower. You do need to deliver a certain amount of radiation dose to generate diagnostic image quality, but the fact that nowadays we can do that at a much lower level of radiation than we have used previously, that practice clearly needs to be encouraged across the country and, in fact, worldwide.
Do you anticipate most radiologists having to report coronary CT in the future?
Coronary artery CT is seen as an area for those with a specific cardiac interest, but I think the demand is growing so significantly, and with the technology developing such that it's a more straightforward scan, I'm sure it won't be long before this is taken as a general radiology technique. So for you and your trainee colleagues, now's a really good time just to get into this, because there's clearly, obviously, it requires training opportunities, but I think that I would foresee that within 5-10 years, this will become such a standard investigation that actually all practicing radiologists will be able to perform it.
That's brilliant. Next, we'll speak to Professor Finn. He'll tell us a bit about himself and talk about his article.
Okay, I'm a radiologist at UCLA. At the David Geffen School of Medicine here in Los Angeles. I'm a professor of radiology with secondary appointments in medicine and biomedical physics. And clinically, I perform MRI and CT of the cardiovascular system in adults and children.
Thank you very much. Can you please tell us some of the key points from your article?
In recent times, we've had some issues with gadolinium-based contrast agents, which took us by surprise. About 10 years ago, when nephrogenic systemic fibrosis was recognized as being associated with gadolinium use in patients with end-stage renal disease, this sort of put the community on alert that gadolinium agents, which had been in use basically with a tremendous safety profile for 20 years, maybe weren't as safe as we had assumed. So the association with NSF really put the community on alert and really changed the way we had to screen patients for renal disease when we're using gadolinium. From a vascular imaging perspective, that had a dramatic impact, because gadolinium was used in fairly high dose for performing MR angiography and had been extremely successful. But because of the issue with NSF, it really made a big difference to the practice of MR angiography. But the practice gradually recovered. But in the meantime, some workers had pointed out that ferumoxytol, which is an iron-based agent and is not associated with NSF, was really a potential alternative to gadolinium in these patients. And initially, some workers at UCSF and around about the same time at Duke University had published some seminal papers just basically highlighting early work with ferumoxytol in patients with renal failure. And that in turn really grabbed our attention here, so we started to use it and discovered that it was a very, very powerful and versatile agent, not just, you know, for renal failure patients, which is where it has its main initial clinical impact, but also for a variety of other types of patients and also for children with congenital heart disease. So we have really developed an interest in ferumoxytol on a fairly broad base of clinical applications over the past 3 years. And whereas the gadolinium agents are generally extracellular agents in that they distribute in the plasma and the interstitial fluid space and they're eliminated by renal filtration, ferumoxytol is very much a blood pool agent. It stays in the bloodstream for several hours with a half-life of about 15 hours. So that means once it's injected, after a minute or so, its concentration is very stable. And that has a lot of implications about what one can do and how one can do it. And many of these are summarized in the paper in Clinical Radiology.
Are you one of the only centers who actually use it?
To my knowledge, it is only available commercially in the U.S. at the moment, and it's approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration as a therapy agent for patients with chronic kidney disease to treat their anemia. So that's its clinical indication, basically as an iron supplement. Although it was originally designed and developed as an MRI contrast agent, around 2005, I believe, the company decided not to pursue an imaging indication, I suspect because they believed that it would have a very niche application, because at that point the gadolinium agents were being used very successfully vascular imaging, and it looked as if ferumoxytol might have too narrow a base of applications. I'm speculating a little because I don't have first-hand information, but that I believe is what happened. So for the past 7 years or so, since 2009, ferumoxytol has been approved by the FDA for intravenous iron therapy in patients with chronic kidney disease in the US. Then for a short while it was marketed in Europe by a Japanese company as, I believe, Rienzo, but it came off the market, I understand, for commercial reasons a couple of years ago and is no longer available. So for purely practical reasons, it's not available outside of the US. And then within the US, it was being used by several institutions in a research capacity and still is. But in March of 2015, the US FDA issued a black box warning because they had noted that 79 patients had developed severe hypersensitivity reactions in the therapy arena, in the post-marketing surveillance. So they basically issued a warning saying that it shouldn't be injected rapidly and should be used with a lot of forethought and only with a strong clinical indication. So that really, I think, caused a lot of people who were planning to use ferumoxytol. I think it had a very negative, demotivating effect because of the FDA warning, understandably. From our perspective, we were already very far down the road using the agent clinically, and also we had a research program which had several ferumoxytol-related projects underway. So we got an IND, an investigational new drug exemption, from the FDA to continue our work in pediatric patients with congenital heart disease. So that's important, and that gives us that extra sense of safety and legitimacy. But our experience with ferumoxytol has really been very positive. We have never had any serious adverse events of any kind. We have a paper that's just been accepted by the Journal of Magnetic Resonance Imaging. It summarizes our safety experience in over 200 patients with no adverse events. So I think until, you know, a little more data gets out there on the benefit to risk relationship with ferumoxytol, you know, a lot of people might be hesitant to use it, but I have little doubt that these numbers will be coming, and that in many cases, extremely important, sometimes a game-changing agent.
How does the dose of ferumoxytol differ for those used in scanning compared to treatment?
It's less by and large. The therapy dose for an adult patient typically is 0.5 gram of iron given on usually 2 consecutive doses separated by several days. So 1 gram totally and 0.5 gram on each occasion. And also, and here's an important point to note, is that because ferumoxytol was originally developed as an MRI contrast agent, it was developed to be safe for bolus injection. So then when it was used as a therapy agent, the company got that indication, and it was the only agent for therapy, the only iron agent, that had this rapid bolus injection indication. So whereas the other agents were infused over about 15 minutes, the ferumoxytol could be infused over about 17 seconds. So in relative terms, this could generate a huge difference in the peak blood concentration of the agent, and this is probably what was, you know, at the root of a lot of the symptoms and side effects that were observed. But even at that, they were uncommon. So the dose that we use for imaging is on average about 0.5 of the single injection dose that is usually used for therapy.
Okay. So do you foresee that, say, in like 5 or 10 years' time, do you think gadolinium will be completely replaced in both cardiovascular imaging as well as other kinds of imaging using contrast agents for MR?
Oh, gee, that would be a very bold statement on my part. But it's a good question. Do I think it will be completely replaced? Absolutely not. No, gadolinium agents are, you know, they're part of the landscape now, so they're not going away anytime soon. However, I think the time is right to start considering possible alternatives in certain circumstances. And over and above the issue with NSF, again, in the last year or two, there have been several reports of gadolinium deposition in the brain noted in patients even who do not have renal impairment. And this has been observed mostly in the dentate nucleus and the lobus pallidus. And whereas, there have been no clinical features associated with this yet, people have found it just a little bit disturbing. And the fact that gadolinium is retained in the body for years or maybe permanently is something that people hadn't realized before or hadn't thought about. And this, I think, has ignited a lot of debate about gadolinium agents in general and the types of agents and whether, you know, there should be some alternative strategies. But over and beyond that, ferumoxytol is different not just in containing iron to the gadolinium agents, but in its biodistribution and its pharmacokinetics. It's very different. It's a true intravascular agent for at least 15 hours. After that, it gets slowly taken up by the reticuloendothelial system. But for an entire day, one can think of it as being an intravascular agent without, leaking to any great degree into the extracellular fluid space. So it behaves very differently to the majority of the gadolinium agents, other than probably Eovist, which is a specific liver agent. And that means that, one can look at different things and in different ways. So it has a different elemental core, and in many ways that's comforting because we all need iron, we don't need gadolinium, but also because of its kinetics and its relaxivity properties, it's quite potent on a per dose level. It can do things and show things that the gadolinium agents cannot. So will it play a role? I think once we can, elucidate the safety issues, I think it could be profoundly impactful and could certainly change the way we do a lot of imaging with MRI.
Sounds fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
The article itself would, I think, refer to most of the points I'd like to make to the readership. And I do feel very positive about the enormous potential of this agent in many ways. And I don't have time to go into the additional, practical applications and so forth. But every day, clinically, we come across cases where this seems to be an ideal agent to use, where nothing else will work well. It may be the iPhone for MRI in some ways. In that, until we had it, we didn't know we needed it.
Thank you. That concludes our podcast. We hope you've enjoyed listening and you'll join us for our next one.